world as well, judged by their, what do you do? What do you do? That's like one of the first questions. What do you do? Well, I don't know about you, but I work like I always have since I was 17 years old to survive. What do I want to do? I want to not work, okay? Or at least, you know, and, you know, I'm not using work in the general sense of any activity that produces value, because it could be you're producing value for yourself or your family or for something other than a freaking corporation. But you want to know, next time someone asks me what I do, I say, well, I spend my time trying to figure out how not to work, and so far I've failed terribly because I'm always working and it's just horrible, you know. So there you go. Oh, you don't like your job? No, I hate my job. You know, in America we're taught, say, be positive. You like your job. Oh, my job is so interesting and this and that. Your job sucks. I know it sucks. Don't pretend. Your job sucks. Even if you have a good job, quote unquote, it still sucks because it's not what you expected. You know, you get a job that you like in a field you like, and then you find out they're just doing it to make money. And they're cutting corners, and you can't do what you need to do to make your job worthwhile or make the thing you're participating in, the good or the service, the best it can be, because it's all about money for the boss. So don't go around saying you like your job. Drop that crap, Americans. You know, that's my editorial moment. You're listening to WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford, and this is Socialist Alternative Radio. And 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio, Commercial Free Radio, and community-based radio, and we're a little slice of that community base, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. We cover a lot of ground here. By the way, speaking of healthcare and daycare and all that stuff we were talking about, I don't know, I'm not going to talk about that. I was going to describe a picture over the air. I got to remember this is radio and not television. I have it on TV a little bit, and I don't care about TV. But anyway, it was okay. Hey, did you know, you probably heard, okay, about this thing with Market Basket in Massachusetts. You might have heard about it. This is a thing that happened last year, I believe it was. Might have been 2 years ago, but I think it was last year, where a CEO, a boss, a big boss, like one of the co-founders and co-owners of the company, was being tossed out of the company by the rest of the corporate board. And that went public because and I'm not going to call them workers. I think it was upper-level management and lower-level management that really engineered and directed the whole thing. But some managers in the company decided to defend their manager boss, higher boss. And they did this by a lot of media campaigning and a lot of trying to get the workers from the stores to engage in these protests that they ended up having and stuff like that. So it was making this... this company, publicly held, I think it's publicly held, maybe it's privately held in terms of the legal definition of the word, but making this company called Market Basket, or Demoulas, as it's also known locally, grocery store chain, pretty big chain, giving them some really bad publicity. You know, this campaign was giving them really bad publicity, and the corporate media really got behind it because the ideological factor was off the charts for them. It was like, people, we can paint this as workers supporting the big boss, the big CEO, you know, at a time when actually inequality and growing inequality and all the stuff left over from Occupy and people protesting for $15 minimum wage and all that was the thing they wanted to really ignore and couldn't. But here is the opposite narrative. Here's people from Market Basket, where they don't make $15 an hour, believe you me. In fact, Diego, who called earlier, said on the air here a couple times what it was like. He worked at Market Basket two different times, and it was horrible both times. It was horrible in terms of low pay. It was horrible in terms of racism against immigrants and people of color. It was horrible in terms of just the basic grind, the basic exploitation, super exploitation in that Market Basket engages in. But all of a sudden, Market Basket, and nobody knows about that, right? I mean, even at the time that this Market Basket propaganda campaign was going on about how great this big boss was, I forget his name, thank goodness, I don't want to give him any more publicity, this big CEO, how great he was and how his workers were fighting for him was actually managers mostly. That at the same time, they had fired a bunch of locked into a building, a store, routinely janitors. You know, they'd go in, they'd be locked in, they have to clean, they have nowhere to eat lunch or whatever. This is during the night. They'd have to go, be let out, And finally, the janitors kind of got organized and said, "No, this is we're not animals. We're going to protest." They were fired, and then they sued the company. This was all happening, but the corporate media kept that, of course, off the main pages completely, or almost completely. And it's just this narrative of the bosses. This big boss is just so loved by the workers, and the corporate media ate that right up. They just loved it. Well, this is all prelude, and it was all a lie, basically, and things suck at Market Basket for the workers. And one thing they do at Market Basket is things they say how long they've been there. Next time you go to Market Basket, check out those little tags on the workers. They don't all have them, but some of them do, how long they've been at Market Basket. And most of them have been there like very little time. And if it was such a great job, you think they would be leaving? You think they would be, you know, there'd be such a high turnover? Of course not. It sucks there. But for a while, everyone was believing it was great, including leftists, including people that should know better. They were like, yeah, support the Market Basket workers in their attempt to get this CEO, you know, brought in, brought back. Can you imagine? That stuff happens all the time, actually, you know? I mean, that's just another form of lesser evilism in a way. It's a form of, like, there's Marxists that should know better to support Democratic Party politicians, right? That's the big disease of the left in the United States. That's why the left is so puny, because people, leftists that know better, should know better, will find a way to justify supporting Democratic Party politicians. And they'll do that, and then they'll wonder why they never get anywhere. Because you're just supporting the boss. And then you're telling the other workers, that's what matters, supporting the boss. And this was a very blatant part of that at Market Basket. So then there was another story like this in Lawrence, Massachusetts, where a guy named a boss who owned a factory, a textile factory, was a hero years ago. Feuerstein, what was this person? Aaron Feuerstein. He owned Malden Mills until 2007. And they made a big mythology about him. And when the place burnt down, he tried to rebuild the factory, did rebuild it, gave the workers some extra money, although they still had a long time where they weren't being paid. And the company, he basically sold the company, like that didn't work, you know? Like I'll even say, okay, let's say that this guy, Aaron Feuerstein, is a nice guy, even though he's a capitalist. Fully admit that. Marxists are not hating individual capitalists. Marxists are about hating the capitalist class and its control over the means of production and you know, the production of goods and services. That's what keeps capitalism the nasty, destructive system, wasteful system that it is, right? So it's not you could have an individual capitalist that tries to be nice. But up back to the beginnings of Marxism, Marxists have actually studied that. There was a guy named Owen, I believe, if I'm getting the name right, who set up factories early on in the capitalist development of capitalism in England, tried to set up factories in a more humane way. Now, the definition of humane back then was 10-hour days and still having child labor and stuff like that, although I think Owen said no child labor. And he tried to set up factories with a lot of social welfare around them, education opportunities and stuff like that. Of course, he couldn't keep up with the competition. So here's this guy Feuerstein, who people claim, the media claims, did give what they consider a relative, I would say very relatively, more to the workers than another boss in the same situation. And yet, what was the bottom line? The bottom line was he could not recover from the fire. The company was in debt. And unable to pay the debt off, Feuerstein sold the company. That wasn't a good thing there, you know, obviously, and out of bankruptcy, to Versa Capital Management, a venture capital firm specializing in, you got it, restructurings and turnarounds and reorganizations and liquidations. So there's a lot of companies, in case you haven't been following this, neoliberal capitalism, which, again, is really just the old capitalism. But it has been, they make their money off of going around and buying up distressed, let's call them, businesses, and then, you know, making it worse, basically, and trying to liquidate the whole thing into their coffers. And that process has continued since 2007, where they changed the name from Malden Mills to Polar Tech. They had a lot of market share, apparently, according to this article, which is by Alex Lubin, L-U-B-B-E-N, Lubin, in these times, March 29, 2016. Versa Capital Management, once they took over, they did actually get a lot of business for creating the stuffing, the insides of a lot of, these jackets that, these winter jackets that cost so much freaking money to buy, like North Face and all that. Let me see if they list some of the corporations that they actually sold their crap to. REI, I guess. That might be one of them. Patagonia, North Face, L.L. Bean. Yeah, you got it. U.S. military. Actually had a lot of business. Well, what are they doing? Well, they're going to shut down the unionized Lawrence factory and move it to a non-union so-called right-to-work state, which means anti-union state. Which one was it? It's in the article somewhere. Tennessee, I believe. Tennessee. And so the union, Unite H-E-R-E, is, of course, trying to stop this, but in a very weak way, basically doing a corporate campaign type thing, put pressure on this huge company, Polartec, which also has a company, a factory in China, et cetera, by getting people that invest, companies like, for example, retirement systems or retirement plans that invest in, or schools that invest in, school retirement plans that invest in Polartec to take their money out or to pressure the companies. This whole corporate strategy developed in the 80s that failed miserably. Instead of occupying the factory and looking into other struggles, the only hope, taking it under public ownership, the only real hope for keeping those jobs in Lawrence, and that's not happening. So the other thing that we mentioned, capitalism, concessions are gained on the one hand through struggle by the workers and then taken away, can be taken away almost immediately, taken away by the other hand, taken away by just the normal operation of capitalism, the daily grind of capitalism. So, it's kind of funny for the society or the corporate media, let's say, to all of a sudden over the last couple of years start talking about student debt as it was a totally new phenomenon. Now, it is a worsening phenomenon. It's a thing that is sort of certainly worse than at other times under the history of capitalism in the United States, but it's nothing new, okay? And anyone that's gone to college knows how freaking expensive it was even before it's gotten really, really expensive, So it's, again, we're talking about relative terms here, but we're also talking about so-called, the chickens coming home to roost, so to speak, in that they've made it so expensive. They made education such a commodity in the United States that people just can't afford to pay it back. Like, they're told, you're given this basically dilemma, this Hobson's choice when you're young. You say, you got to go to college. You don't go to college, you can't get a decent job anymore. That's referring to the fact that maybe in the 50s and 60s, when there was more manufacturing, you could graduate or even drop out of high school and find, if you got a union job or a job that was influenced by a high union density in that industry, you could get you could live on that job. You could actually buy a house maybe, and so on. And nowadays, as the lecture goes, you can't get squat without a college degree. You can't get anything without a college degree, or something like it, like a technical degree or something like that. And so this forces millions and tens of millions of Americans, many of whom don't even want to go to college, and I don't blame them in some ways, to sacrifice everything they can for something they can't afford. They just can't afford it. It's just too expensive. And college should be free. And not just Bernie Sanders, right-wing social democrat-like public school free, because in Europe they find ways to mess with that through tests and so on. College should just be free, 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 like healthcare. Everything that with the name college should be free. Yep, that includes Harvard. Yes, it does. Free. Should be free. Education is a right. It's a right. It is not something you play with. It's not a commodity for you to make profit off of big bosses. And then someone might be thinking, well, wait a minute, like the school I go to is nonprofit. Well, that's just a tax dodge. Let's take Harvard, where I work, for example. They're making billions and billions of money. There goes the police to arrest the president of Harvard. I wish. It's actually the fire department. It's a tax dodge, nonprofit status. They still make billions and billions of profit, just absolute write-out profit from rents and from owning businesses and partially owning businesses and fees and tuition and everything else you can think of, right? They're just not paying dividends out to shareholders, at least not obviously, not in the sense of a publicly held corporation, but they're paying big salaries to presidents and CEOs, right? They're paying big salaries to administrators. So you have a situation where nonprofit, you got to look at it a little more carefully. And also, what about all the help those businesses are getting? You know, say you're, okay, maybe you're not the capitalist on the board of the business that Harvard is investing in, but you know the capitalist on the board of the business that Harvard is investing in. You know, or maybe you are on the board of some business. Maybe that's not considered a conflict of interest these days. And Harvard invests billions of dollars or millions of dollars into that business, which is perfectly legal, even with its nonprofit status. There was that bit of a scandal that one of the Bushes got, George himself, like the latest one that was in power as president. Harvard bought up a lot of an oil company that he owned, saved his bacon in terms of that company, right? And that was a bit of a scandal because I think he went to the business school, which shows you the intellectual caliber of the Harvard Business School. And also, he then became president and all that stuff. So that was a little bit of a raised eyebrow here or there in arcane hidden corners of the corporate media. But that's it. Got away with it. Get away with it every day, you know? But the main point is that as they make billions and billions off of the commodification of education, which should be a human right, the capitalists and by the way, these straight up capitalists sitting on the board of these corporations, for the most part, these nonprofit schools, meanwhile, students who are I would say forced to go to college, you know, and a pro capitalist libertarian type would say, no one's forcing you to go to college. What conditions are forcing you to go to college, idiot? That's what I'm talking about. And that's what everyone's talking about when they say we're forced to do something. It's usually not because someone has a gun to your head per se. It's because maybe further down the line, they'll have a gun to your head when they're marching you off to prison. Or more to the point, conditions are forcing you to act a certain way in society. So in U.S. society, more and more students are forced to take the roulette wheel of a college education, get in there as a marble in that roulette wheel, and maybe when it stops, there'll be a job somewhere for them. Maybe not, and maybe that job will pay a decent amount, but mostly not. We know that. And how do you pay back those huge student loans with the low-paying jobs that are out there? You don't. So, excuse the coughing, that must be interesting. Here's an article, Friday, April 8th, from Wall Street Journal. There it is, the mouth of the capitalists themselves. More than 40%, quote-unquote here, more than 40% of student borrowers aren't making payments. That's almost half, people. New figures raises worries that millions of them may never repay more than $200 billion owed. Now, just a little editorial comment. I hope to hell they don't pay it off. I hope the banks get screwed completely on these loans because they shouldn't be loans to begin with. And interest on loans like that? No, no, no. Loans bad enough. Interest on the loans? Forget about it. So I hope this $200 billion, the banks have to eat it. And they could. It's pennies to them. But I hope they have to eat that completely. That's my position here, by the way. Completely. I'm not worried they won't complete their payments. What I'm worried about is they're going to get their wages garnished. Like, I know somebody who got his wages garnished is a nice way. It's not a garnish. It's not like putting, you know, paprika or what is that stuff, the green stuff, on your... It's not a garnish as in your restaurant food to make it look nice. It is stealing your wages to pay a bank, right? Or because you kept your student loans, because you couldn't pay your student loans. So I know someone that, where they reached in years after he graduated from college, reached into his piddly paycheck and took out money to pay some bank for something that should have been free to begin with. And that's what garnishing your wages means. And that's what it means in terms of the student loan stuff. So, more than 40% of Americans who borrowed from the government's main student loan program are making payments or are behind on more than $200 billion owed. While most have since left school and joined the workforce, 43% of the roughly 22 million Americans with federal student loans weren't making payments as of January 1st, according to a quarterly snapshot of the Education Department's $1.2 trillion student loan portfolio. Nice graphic, Wall Street Journal. They compare student loan and auto loan debt and how much is in default. Oh, you got a trillion in auto loan defaults, by the way. You have 1.2 trillion in student loan defaults, debt, not default, not straight up defaults. You've got 3.6 million in default, 3 million delinquent, 3 million in postponement, and 12.5 million current. About 1 in 6 borrowers are a default, another way of looking at it, on 56 billion in student debt. Meaning they'd gone at least a year without payment, etc. Now, what's also interesting about this article is they interview, you know, students, a couple students, and they're just like, "Yeah, this is my degree is worthless, and I'm supposed to pay it back. How do I pay it back, etc." And it's getting worse. The problem, apparently. Let's see where was it? Oh yeah, Christopher Matthews, 38 years old. 38 is in deferment on about $11,900 in federal student loans. During the recession, he earned a certificate at a Michigan-based for-profit college that teaches media arts, but he wasn't able to find the well-paying job in radio that they promised. So he now works as a, quote, logistical analyst. That's a fancy term for an auto company. That's probably like looking over loans and stuff, making $46,000 a year. And that might sound good to some people. In the U.S., you know, it's funny where you're at. You know, you might hear these wages that sound really good, but $46,000 a year ain't crap, really, especially when it comes to the fact that he has a family, 3 children, paying off 2 credit cards and a car loan on top of it. So, quote, with all the other necessities in life, I just don't have funds to pay student debt, he said. Once his deferment expires, he said, he isn't sure if he will feel obliged to pay down his loan. Quote, they promised me everything, he said, of his for-profit college, and I honestly have nothing to show for it except a piece of paper that doesn't really do me any good. Now, how many students around the U.S. are saying that to themselves or to somebody on a daily basis? Let's see. The median default is $8,900. Again, pennies for the banks, pennies for the federal government, but they're going to go after these people. You watch. And that's going to be nasty, of course. So that gets into that a little bit. The Education Department, through private debt collection agencies, they subcontract that. A garnished $176 million in Americans' wages in the final 3 months of last year for student debt. That's on top of your taxes and everything else. Yeah, land of the free, home of the brave, all that stuff. May 1st is coming up. What is May 1st? It's International Workers' Day. It is the real Labor Day. It is the day that working people all around the globe celebrate, or should celebrate, many do, through protests, through educational events, through social events, the fact that it's supposed to be our holiday, May 1st. Now, it's not an official holiday in the United States, of course, unfortunately, but it's more and more celebrated. And it's more and more celebrated, one reason, because there are more and more immigrants in the United States, and they bring the traditions of celebrating May 1st from their countries. This year on May 1st, there may be more celebration, more actions around May 1st by immigrants, by workers who aren't immigrants. I know that in Worcester, for example, Worcester, Massachusetts, there's going to be on May 2nd, the day after, a rally in front of the City Hall, and also right in front of the City Hall, the Public Common, for International Workers' Day, sponsored by a coalition of unions and community groups. Socialist Alternative will be part of that. I have a leaflet that we used last year at the May 1st thing in Worcester. May Day, the workers' holiday. Workers have always had to fight for everything we have, from the weekend to the 8-hour day, to less dangerous working conditions, not to mention every wage increase we received. Every year on May 1st, workers in many countries get the day off. Not here in the U.S., by the way. That's not on the leaflet. Unions and workers' political parties organize large demonstrations and celebrations for International Workers' Day. May 1st commemorates events that occurred during the struggle for the 8-hour day in the U.S., even though it's a U.S.-based holiday originally, although right away adopted internationally by the socialist movement at the time. We don't get the day off. But it goes back to the eight-hour day struggle in the U.S. in 1886. Since then, the International Socialist Movement adopted May 1st as an International Workers' Day. This year, that goes on into Worcester a little bit. And we linked it on this leaflet for Fight for 15, for the Black Lives Matter struggle. And also we reported on the victory prior to that, a year or two prior to that, of Shama Sawant that I mentioned earlier, and the 15 minimum wage campaign that was won in Seattle a year after Shama Sawant's election. And Social Alternative playing a big role in that, and $15 minimum wage things that had started actually in SeaTac right next to Seattle, but was blocked by the courts, went to the city council. The campaign that we initiated and got a lot of help with and won on. And then, you know, L.A. did a $50 minimum wage. San Francisco did a $50 minimum wage. A lot of cities, Richmond, California, and cities outside New York has a partial one for fast food workers now. And then we have the one we talked about earlier, the statewide minimum wage in California for 15. That struggle continues. And again, this Thursday, April 14th, 3:30 or around 4:30 p.m., either pick your time, go to the State House downtown near Park Street and protest for $50 minimum wage here in Boston. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back, a musical interlude. Then we're going to come back with some more about what we're talking about, socialism, democratic socialism, stuff about the elections, etc. So stay tuned and enjoy the music.
born in peaceful times. The world in derby spinning around faster, faster. The center cannot hold. Like a world in derby spinning, spinning faster. Ah, oh, the center cannot hold. On the age of reason.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends. And some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were three of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison. Oh, the wind is blowing. Through the graves the wind is blowing. Freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from shadow.
Mais je n'ai pas peur. J'ai repris mon âme. J'ai changé 100 fois de nom. J'ai perdu femme et enfant. Mais j'ai tant d'amis. J'ai la France.
The graves, the wind is blowing. Freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from the shadow.
This is WMFO in Medford, Tufts Free Form, commercial free, community-based radio. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. You just heard Leonard Cohen with the song The Partisan, The Partisan. And that's from The Essential Leonard Cohen, 1967, Columbia put that out. New Model Army, Original 20, Here Comes the War was the song before that. and New Model Army from Britain, in case you haven't heard of them, long-term punk band. Stayed with it for a long time, sort of like the Maycons and others. That are, and they're still around, still making music as far as I know. I have to double check on that. As of a couple of years ago, they were still touring. And right now I'm going to get into something we talk about on the show from time to time. The latest edition of Socialist Alternative's newspaper called Socialist Alternative is out now. If you want any more information about Socialist Alternative, go to socialistalternative.org. You know, and there's other ways to get in touch, info@socialistalternative.org, etc. But the easiest way, just go to the website, socialistalternative.org, and then you can get hooked into local branches of Socialist Alternative. You can find out how to subscribe to our newspaper, etc., etc. So the thing that we have in the paper, almost every issue, is Why I Am a Socialist, where somebody that's just joined, and a lot of people have been joining over the last couple of years, so there's a lot of people to choose from, a lot of new members. They explain why they joined, you know, how they became a socialist, why they joined Socialist Alternative, that kind of thing. So this one was pretty good. Zach Shrewsbury, very good actually, wrote, again, Why I'm a Socialist, picture of Zach. He's a security guard in Seattle, Washington. Zach writes, I first discovered I was a socialist when I was in the Marine Corps, deployed to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, on the fence line. I remember seeing the Cuban soldier across the field from me through my binoculars, and he seemed just the same as I and my friends were, exhausted, hot, and wondering why he was there. Then it dawned on me that that soldier, the so-called enemy, is just like me. I went on to discover and research about socialism after that moment, and by watching the Occupy Wall Street protests, and I became disgusted by the fact that people have to pay thousands of dollars when they get sick. I was angry at the fact that all my friends were graduating college with $40,000 in debt. I was sickened by the fact that women are still fighting to be equal in today's society when it's so obvious they should be. I was enraged that African Americans, Latinos, and Muslims were all being demonized by the media. I became a socialist to fight against all the injustice and equality in this country and the world. I sacrifice for all people so we can all live a life where no one goes hungry or thirsty, a life where sick people are provided for, a life where we are all equals regardless of race, gender, or creed. As Eugene V. Debs said, quote, I have no country to fight for. My country is the earth, and I am a citizen of the world. Comrades, remember to never give up our fight. Never give ground. Solidarity forever. Again, that was a statement by Zach Shrewsbury, a security guard in Seattle, Washington, as to why he became a socialist, why I'm a socialist. And it was read from the latest edition of Socialist Alternative, which is the newspaper of Socialist Alternative. And you can find out more by going to socialistalternative.org on the web, by your computer, or write to info@socialistalternative.org, some email. So if you don't have a computer by any chance, and I know that's rare these days. Someone's got something, a smartphone or whatever. But if you don't, if your access to a computer is a problem and you're still listening to the show live, I would imagine, since you don't have access to a computer, you can. There are other ways to get in touch. You can just call. For example, in Boston, call 910-639-3948. Worcester, 617-285-9346. Nationally, anyone can call in nationally and they'll be directed to the local areas. Call 206, this is a national office in Brooklyn, 206-526-7185. That's 206-526-7185. But again, with access to computer, go to socialistalternative.org. Now, of course, what show about socialism would be, you know, complete without talking about the elections, and basically we have a situation where there's a erstwhile socialist, a nominal socialist, running for office. And so you would think, well, you must support that socialist, right? And well, the answer is not really. I mean, Socialist Alternative officially is actually campaigning for Bernie Sanders, Movement for Bernie, hashtag Movement for Bernie, etc. Look it up. But, you know, in terms of what Sanders really is. He's not really a socialist in terms of what he's going to do. He has said numerous times that if he loses the primary, he will support Clinton. Now, we'll get into that in a second, but let's get into what if he wins the primary. Well, he'll be winning as a Democratic Party politician. And this is my opinion here. He'll be winning as a Democratic Party politician in the Democratic Party. He did not enter this with a party behind him in the sense of a real political party. You could say that perhaps he could take the support he's gotten through the campaign and turn that into some sort of party political party vehicle. The problem with that is that the campaign is a kind of passive thing. It's like you show up to a rally or whatever, and that's good. But then what happens with the excuse me for one second here. I gotta see something technical. Sorry, hold on one second, please. There's something. Okay, all right. And never mind. Okay, what happens if Sanders got elected without any real party behind him? Because if you go to a rally or something, doesn't mean you get hooked into a party structure. Obviously, you're not in a campaign, especially one in the Democratic Party. There's no one making any decisions except the people at the top, except for Sanders himself, and in line with the Democratic Party, top unelected leadership. And so they are engaged in gathering votes, basically getting votes. It's an electoral machine. It's not a political party. And then there's a certain small percentage of people that decide, oh yeah, I believe in this enough that I'm going to, go door to door, get involved in the campaign or whatever. So some people do that for Sanders. Are they then going to are they numerous enough or empowered enough to be some sort of political party once he gets in to organize in support of what he claims to believe in? And the answer is no. That's not enough power there. It would have to be organized from scratch. And does Sanders have it then? What follows is, does Sanders have a record of movement building? The answer is no. He has a clear record of building electoral campaigns, but no record of movement building, even back when in the 70s and 80s when he claimed to be socialist and had that would have some validity to it, that claim. problematic, but still somewhat valid. So then getting into the 90s where he made deals with the Democratic Party, and of course into the 2000s where he became continued that process of working with the Democratic Party hand in glove in Congress, raising money for the Democratic Party, etc. Is it likely that Sanders, if elected, would all of a sudden turn the office of the presidency into some sort of organizing platform? I'd say the answer is no. Would it on its own spur people into action, thinking Sanders has their back and they can fight for things? I'd say maybe, except the betrayals that Sanders will do if he got elected with no party behind him will be very demoralizing to people. And of course, there'll be other forces trying to keep everything quiet. You got your guy in, you got the Democrats in power. Let's focus on getting other Democrats elected, that kind of thing. So it's not a given that Sanders will in any way be able to either trigger or support a movement in favor of, say, a national $15 minimum wage or free public education or single-payer health care, which, by the way, needs to go beyond single-payer to be really good. But anyway, no evidence of that out there. And it's still the most likely scenario through the manipulation of superdelegates and all that is that Clinton will win the primary, the Republican Party primary, despite Sanders winning in a lot of states recently. And the Huffington Post, I believe on April 7th, says, quote, Bernie Sanders says he will, and then for a further quote, in quotes, certainly support Hillary Clinton if she's the Democratic nominee. So just to look at this, as the two Democratic presidential candidates engage in some of the sharpest attacks of the campaign, Senator Bernie Sanders on Thursday affirmed that he would support opponent Hillary Clinton in the general election if she wins the nomination. Now, this isn't news to Socialist Alternative or news to a lot of socialists, I would imagine, or activists on the left. Sanders has said this about Clinton from time to time. they claim in this article, I believe at one point, which I don't have time to read the whole thing, but they claim that he hasn't always said that. And yeah, he hasn't always said that. Sometimes he, one time, in, for example, I think it's the time they're talking about, he kind of waffled on it a little bit. But most of the time, he has gone out of his way to say he would support Clinton, even when not asked. But here he's asked, CBS's news corporate whore Charlie Rose said it in an interview, pressed him, and Sanders said, "Sure, I will," he said. "Look, I said a million times," and that's kind of true, this is Sanders speaking, "I think the idea of a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz presidency would be an unmitigated disaster for this country. I will do everything in my power and work as hard as I can to make sure that that does not happen. And if Secretary Clinton is the nominee, I will certainly support her." So the reason I'm going into that is just to, you know, once again, he's affirming his allegiance to the Democratic Party, in this case through supporting Clinton. And that's, you know, important to understand because, as he said a million times, he doesn't want to be a quote-unquote spoiler. And I would just put forward from that, you know, I know a certain number of people, including people that should know better on the left, are getting wrapped up in the horse race aspect, the competitive winner or non-winner aspect of elections, because that's what the corporate media focuses on, and for good reason. That erases a lot of people that might still have a chance to gain support in an election, or that are raising issues that the corporate media doesn't want to deal with, etc. So when you think, oh boy, Sanders doesn't want all this stuff, I'm not just saying, well, think about the game is rigged. That's true. It is rigged. Sanders knew that going in. That's why I don't feel sorry for him there. He should have run as an independent. Social Alternative called on him to run as an independent from day one. And we're still calling on him to run as an independent from, you know, through November, basically. Sanders should run as an independent. He should not go through the process of the primary. Now, if you read Social Alternative material, it kind of says, well, if he doesn't win, he should run as an independent. I think that's how it reads. I would argue that he should immediately declare himself independent, get himself out of the grasp of the Democratic Party, which is totally corporate dominated, and run as an independent. And maybe hook up with Jill Stein from the Green Party, who's running, obviously, outside the corporate party duopoly, outside the Democrats and Republicans. She's running as a Green. And they should run together on a ticket. If Sanders follows through, which is most likely, on his promise to support Clinton and loses the primary, which is most likely, then he will, then of course the thing to do for socialists would be to vote for Jill Stein, or not just for socialists, for anybody, because anybody that thinks lesser evilist politics, meaning voting for the more progressive so-called Democrat or facing other Democrat, facing Republicans, if that gets us anywhere, if that's gotten us anywhere in the last 30, 40 years, you prove it to me, because it hasn't. It has resulted in weaker unions, much, much weaker, almost gone, almost destroyed unions. It's resulted in declining living standards, et cetera, because, you know, the Democrat, when the Democrat gets in power, whether it's Hillary Clinton or whoever, they're going to do the bidding of big business and of the corporations. And there's no time like the present or even yesterday to have started the process of building an independent voice for working people, a party of the 99%, a workers' party, however you want to phrase it. We need independent of big business, independent of corporations and their money, politics happening in this country on a wide scale. It doesn't have to be the presidency right off the bat, but it could be local elections, like Shama Sawant getting elected in Seattle and so on as an independent socialist, as an open socialist, a member of Social Alternative. There's a lot of ways to approach it, but the point is, start gathering the forces together now and using the elections as a way to do that, or just dump everyone in the Democratic Party, or point everyone towards the Democratic Party and away from the efforts that are going on through the Jill Stein campaign and through other avenues of getting the forces together for a third party, as people like to say. That's really not a very politically useful term, but a third party in the sense of a progressive, pro-worker, anti-capitalist party that would not get its money from big business, that would fight the Democrats and the Republicans in every election it could, and not turn people, or as Black Agenda Report said, not sheepdog people like Sanders is doing into the Democratic Party. That's extremely important. So, you know, you really need to wake up if you have illusions in Sanders. Think about the institutions, not just the individual, that are at play here. Think about the system that's at play here. And think about what happens the day after the election that will put working people and the socialist movement in a better position. A vote for someone that will sell out as they're elected, or someone that will sell out during the primaries, or a movement based on people, based on issues, that will build a political movement that can fight electorally and also fight outside the electoral realm. When I explained that Sanders was not a movement builder, that's specifically what I had in mind. I've studied his history. I was aware of him long before the corporate media started reporting on him nationally, because he's from this area, from Vermont, and he did run as a socialist for mayor. So when I was a socialist, that, of course, got me interested. I've been a socialist for a long time. So I was basically like, oh, interesting. Following his career, and the disappointing thing about Sanders is that he doesn't try to build, or he stopped trying to build at a certain point, any kind of third-party movement, again, progressive third-party, workers' party, that kind of thing, which has really, and then he dove full into the Democrats in the 90s, despite the independent label. He was working with them as not as an independent, and now he's registered as a Democrat and a full-blooded Democrat, so to speak, full-fledged Democrat. And that brings with it, of course, the whole system, imperialism, and the whole rest of it. And despite some progressive issues, that doesn't erase what's really going on. Okay, so basically, we're going to have to start wrapping it up. It's 12:50. An article I wanted to get into, some stuff I wanted to get into historically. I'll just point out sort of a headline. Check out In These Times, Sean Richman from April 6th. Quote, Bernie Sanders wasn't our first socialist mayor, remembering Milwaukee's Socialist Party history. Very good article in some ways weak, definitely from a conservative wing of socialism is the standpoint, but still a lot of information about a activist named Frank Ziedler, who served as three-term mayor as a Socialist Party candidate in Milwaukee, and not that long ago, actually, from 1948 to 1960. And this guy, you know, survived McCarthyism and so on. Very, very worth reading. Maybe we'll get back to it next time. Also, you may have noticed recently, in terms of election coverage, Clinton saying she was for $15 minimum wage. I don't know how aware many of you are about that, but it did happen. And that's, you know, shows the pressure from the movement on 15, shows the pressure from Sanders picking that up as a demand as well. But what it also shows is the fact that, you know, she kind of said, and the media kind of said, that somehow she was taking credit for some of the victories. The Democratic Party could take credit for some of the victories. This is not true at all. Basically, the $15 minimum wage movement came, as I said, from the labor movement in SeaTac, right next to Seattle originally, and then was picked up and moved forward by Socialist Alternative through the Shama Sawant election campaign in Seattle. Got power there, got a law passed, $15 minimum wage law passed in Seattle in 2013, and then it went to, or maybe it was 2014, I think it was 2013, and then it's gone since then to become the labor movement fighting for it in coalition with other community groups and so on in many different cities. And you just had California statewide pass $15 minimum wage law. So that's really excellent news. And I'm sorry, Hillary does not get any credit for that. In fact, she was recently just saying that she was for $12 an hour, and I have yet to see a direct quote, actually. Maybe I haven't looked hard enough where she says she's for $15, but I've seen papers reporting on the fact that she's recently come out for that. So remember where $15 now came from. did not come from the Clinton campaign or the Democrats. It came from the unions, from the left, from Socialist Alternative, and other left groups from the streets. And it will continue in that kind of vein. And turn out April 14th, this Thursday, at 3:30 or 4:30 p.m. in front of the State House for more fighting on, or struggling for, the $15 minimum wage as a statewide law here in Massachusetts. If it gets passed in Massachusetts after it's been passed in California, then that's going to be excellent. And we're going to see even more fights in other states get inspired from that. One thing I did not get time to report on, you'll have to check out for yourself, is the movement in France happening right now, where the unions and the left are leading a struggle that a lot of average working class people and a lot of youth have joined over the last couple weeks against a loi de travail, or labor law, put forward by, again, an ostensibly socialist government. I think Sanders would act a lot like this guy. His name is Hollande. He's the prime minister of France, and he's put forward regressive, very regressive legislation that would make it easier for workers to be laid off, to be fired. They would cut their benefits if they were laid off. It's a horrible law, and the protest movement has, even though France has a rich tradition of protest movements, the size of the protest, the fact that the youth are so involved, even though it started as a union protest, is really amazing. It's taken on recently the sort of type of protest that happened during the Occupy movement here in the U.S. of occupying squares and so on. It's called Nuit Debout, which basically means stand up at night, or I don't know how they're translating it. They're translating night to stand up, or night to stand, I don't know. There's different ways you can translate that. And I had a whole bunch of stuff on that. No time. Sorry, but check. That's getting not so much in the corporate media here, but you can look on, again, Socialist Alternative. You can look at the Committee for Works International website, socialistworld.net, which Socialist Alternative is in political solidarity with. You can look in places like commondreams.org. You can look at where else have I found material on that. Actually, it's kind of some kind of strange places. It would be hard to explain. let me see. That's, I don't mean that as strange. They're not really strange. There's the... I don't know how to give the citation for this. It's a news network, sort of like a YouTube news network. And again, when you get to the print function, a lot of these places, a lot of these websites, they should learn that their print function erases for some reason their corporate logo. Real news network. There you go. Okay. And of course, from Gauche Révolutionnaire, which is, if you read French, the French section of the Committee for Workers International. So Nuit Debout protests throughout France. Check them out. There was a big protest yesterday. Also, it was the 100th anniversary of the Easter 1916 uprising in Ireland. No time to go into that. And anyway, we'll save that for the next show. You've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we hope that you've enjoyed the show, that you'll tune in every other Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we're going to go out with a song by John Lennon, one of our theme songs. We have a bunch for the show. And please go to the rally this Thursday. Take time off if you need to, if you can, 3:30 p.m. or 4:30 p.m. in front of the State House in Boston, the Gold Dome building run by big business. Go out there, make noise for a $15 minimum wage statewide. Thanks for listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. Go to socialistalternative.org or go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook for more information. And good luck with the class struggle. We all need it. Sky.